the Spectre's Lands. From the jagged course of Jamaica's southern shore to the spine of the Blue Mountains, the Spectre's Domain casts its invisible shadow over this sunny land. The Jamaicans somehow know when they walk within his borders. They grow nervous and sullen. No great wonder, for they have been returned to the slavery of 3 centuries ago. They work tiny plots of cultivated ground that form islands amongst the riotous growth of returned wild trees and grasslands. Viewed from a buzzard's eye high above, the topography resembles that of a tangle of grapevines, dollops of tended lands connected by 1 or 2 main roads. Smaller trails cut through patches of forest, with the vine's principal stalks growing out of what used to be Kingston. A few swaths cut in the red earth of the hills at the bauxite mines yield the makings of aluminum. This export is shipped north and west in return for the few technological necessities the Spectre needs to maintain his control. Slave labor, carried out at a dead slow pace, tends the fields in this, one of the most backwards and ill-governed of the multitude of Kurian principalities. Organization is nil. Construction is moribund, maintenance haphazard. Technology, with the exception of the bauxite mines, under rust-streaked signs with the word Jamalco sometimes still visible, and the guns in the hands of the Spectre's Chinese quislings, has slipped back into a stage somewhere between the Neolithic implements of the Arawaka Indians and the 18th century. It is not unusual to see the land worked by stone tools before the slaves go home to rude huts lit by charcoal fires. The Jamaicans have resorted to an atavistic belief system filled with good luck charms, incantations, and totemism to keep the reapers from the door. Rocks or coral painted with designs in chicken blood can be seen on some doorsteps, below patterned threads of beads that sway in every window. Some families never eat after noon, in the not unreasonable belief that an empty belly makes the body less visible to the reaper's senses. The reapers, in the manner of wild predators, usually pick off the aged, the sick, or the few who try to flee. The Spectre's cloaked avatars often lurk on the beaches and borders, taking those who try to escape over the mountains or into the cockpit country of the Northwest. While the reapers isolate and then kill individual troublemakers, any sort of mass disturbance is a matter for the horsed police and public police. With their intimidating combination of horses, dogs, guns, and clubs, the Spectre uses them in one of the oldest tricks in the tyrant's playbook, that of keeping one race under control by using another. The horsed police are of mixed ethnicity, Chinese-Jamaican and Indian-Jamaican predominating. They control the more numerous but less disciplined members of the public police, little more than baton-waving bands of thugs, but effective enough in controlling the workers on their plantations. The great privilege of the public police is being allowed to use small boats to claim the cod, rock beauties, and parrotfish from the surrounding waters, though their better-fed families suffer nearly as much from the reapers as the ordinary Jamaicans who work the crops and mines. The Spectre rests at the apex of this pyramid of power and fear, an engorged demigod swollen on the rich life aura of the island's fecund people. Cunning as a grave robber, for 40 years he has jealously guarded his island paradise, turning down overtures of fellow Kurian princes to join him on the island, and one attempt to wrest it from him by force. From a European-style castle overlooking a wide bay, he feeds off one of the first discoveries of the New World as a maggot feeds off a corpse, decomposing anything he touches like a necroptic King Midas. With only the irritation of pirates to the north and a few scattered gangs in the mountains, hardly enough to threaten him even in the unlikely event that they united, one could wonder if he would have given the news that there was a cat on the island much thought, so secure is he in his habits, behind his walls, guarded by 1,000 guns and the ferocious teeth of his reapers. It took all of 3 days for David Valentine to cross a 1,200-yard field. In fairness, the first day hardly counted. It had been spent surveying the estate's lands. The more rugged ground sloping down toward the bay turned into fields and orchards closer to the castle. A road servicing the Kurian's home wandered westward along the coast, and eastward toward a settlement centered in the ruins of a beautiful colonial Spanish square. The immediate lands beyond the castle's pebble-colored faces were filled with tobacco fields, stretching out from the walls like a green carpet. The distinctive odor tickled Valentine's sensitive nostrils as he allowed his nose a moment's play in the air from his perch in a palm. He had surveyed farms with staple crops, fruit trees, and livestock, but this was the first tobacco field he had seen since being dropped off by Utari's fast-sailing sloop. The first order of business was to get a feel for the rhythms of the castle's lands, filling in gaps in the knowledge of local spies. The Spectre relied on his reapers to guard the castle and the tobacco fields at night. Valentine had made sure of that after the second day's observation. Ordinary Jamaicans avoided the acres around the castle as if the air were toxic. Women dressed in neat cotton smocks or heavy black dresses worked the Spectre's personal fields and orchards as their children played amongst the crops. Valentine guessed by the quality of their clothing and shoes that they were families of his horsed police. They worked in a curiously lackadaisical, though not disorganized, manner. Valentine had seen many fields where the people under the Curian thumb worked with the maniacal intensity brought on by knowing that whoever turned in fewer bushels at the end of a season would go to the reapers. The reapers, with their innate ability to sense human beings by the life sign they projected, could spot anyone approaching the castle at night across the fields. Thus had the brave Jamaican band died the night they came to kill the Spectre. The men might as well have approached the castle shooting off Roman candles. At night, a cluster of humans could be marked miles away by a prowling reaper. Even a lone man would show up in the empty fields as if a spotlight were shining on him from one of the four corner towers. But Valentine was another matter. The Life Weaver training of 6 years as a hunter had taught him to shield his life sign through mental discipline, a practice of shutting down parts of his mind until he became intent as a prowling cat, thinking only of the furtive scratching of the rat in the drainpipe ahead. Once in the proper mental state, it was as if a skeleton wearing his body were performing on a stage, marionetted by invisible strings from himself somewhere in a balcony above. Jamaica's tropical growth and abundant animal life generated its own form of life sign, masked him from the prowling reapers, and allowed him to remain at the edge of the fields in comparative safety. He had another ability, equally useful but less explicable, even to the seemingly all-knowing life weavers who had selected and trained him. Valentine could sense a nearby reaper, mirroring its own ability to detect life sign, though his own senses were far less precise than those of the vampiric reapers. He once described the sensation to Alessa Duvalier as akin to feeling where the sun is with your eyes shut. Though, to be more accurate, it felt more like a cold presence in his mind, the creepy alarm that most people experience sometime in their lives when they wake up suddenly with the fear that someone is in their bedroom. The ability was unpredictable. Sometimes he could sense a reaper moving on a wooded slope a mile away, but other times walk over one sleeping in a basement below him with only a vague feeling of unease. In the absence of any authoritative opinion, Valentine formed a theory that his ability had to do with the mental connection between the reaper and its master Curian, but like most theories, it was probably half right at best. Anecdotal evidence suggested there were others like him. Stories filtered in from elsewhere about other hunters with the talent, but he had never met one and compared notes. From the uncomfortable cradle of a palm tree, Valentine spent the second night concentrating on lowering his life sign and sensing the reaper's movements. For what the sense was worth, and the more precise evidence of eyes, ears, and nose during his observation, he determined that the Spectre loosed two reapers to prowl his lands at night. One watched from the castle tower nearest the road. As would be expected, they retired with the dawn before the first women appeared on the road from the old colonial town. Valentine spent the third day in a long, agonizing crawl into the tobacco fields. Burdened by Anka's oversized gun and decorated with some of the broad leaves cut from the crop, he inched through the fields at a speed a determined beetle could pace. The crawl, punctuated by drowsy half-naps in the shadow of the tobacco stalks, gave him time to reflect on his plans. It was long past the point where he could change them, but his mind was nonetheless plagued with worries that he barred from his nighttime meditations.
What if the Thunderbolt was delayed in its journey?
Her diesels were reliable, but so ancient, a breakdown could not be discounted.
How long can I stretch my two canteens in this heat, when one's got only a mouthful or two of water left?
He might be able to hide his life sign from Reapers, but he had seen lean brown dogs chasing and playing with the children as their families worked. Suppose one scented him and started barking. His cumbersome, single-shot grog gun would be almost worthless in a running fight with the horsed police. Could Valentine get close enough to the castle so he could be sure of the leaf sights on the rifle? Some unknown pirate of the Commodore's command had looted the gun's telescopic lens, which would have allowed him to take advantage of its range. A strict inquiry among the crew had yielded nothing but shrugs.
I'm sorry, but any kind of optics are almost priceless here.
Valentine had spent two nights awake and taken only brief naps in the day. Suppose he fell asleep lying amongst the tobacco stalks on the most dangerous night of all. One vivid dream or a sudden awakening would reveal him to the patrolling Reapers, and that would be the end of him. Even the toughest bear would not challenge multiple Reapers alone at night. Alone, with only fear to keep him company, Valentine slithered beneath the tobacco leaves. He wished for the comfort of Anka's presence, but Anka was off to the east somewhere with his grogs and some Jamaican friends of Captain Utari's, hiding from the comment their appearance would excite. Post was resting in the old auxiliary hospital ship on the other side of the island, and the rest of his shipmates in the Thunderbolt were beyond the horizon. The Jamaicans could be trusted to keep secrets from the police and the Spectre's henchmen. But undoubtedly there were a few spies in the community. Suppose one should learn of their presence and a hunt ensue. Right now, the Spectre thought himself secure. But at the first word of a plot, he would retreat to his deepest hole, guarded by the fury of a dozen Reapers, with his mounted men riding to his aid from every station for miles around. What then? Valentine wanted to succeed, not just for the sake of regaining use of the Thunderbolt, but also for the aging Commodore's hopes. There was more to his dream of a free Jamaica than space for his polyglot of buccaneers and refugees. A new freehold in the Caribbean, in alliance with the Dutchmen to the south, might mean much to the larger struggle. Valentine's final plan had come to him only after hearing a description of the Spectre's refuge.
British Empire man built the thing.
Captain Utari relied on both oral tradition and boyhood memory.
It was like out the history book. High walls and towers at the corner. For years it was empty. But the Spectre, he brought it back and set it all up to his liking. They say he do as much digging as building. And it has basements and catacombs beneath. You can see the old devil at times up on his balcony of the towers. Watching us and seeing to Deem.
By us and Deem, the captain meant the Jamaicans and the Asian master caste the Spectre had imposed upon them. On further inquiry, Valentine learned that the balcony faced the sea, looking out on a wide bay. The description transformed his vague idea into a plan. He talked it over, first with Anka, and then, with the grog's refinements, put a finished plan before the triumvirate of the Commodore, Lisi, and Carrasca. He stopped his crawl three quarters of the way across the field. Any closer, and Valentine's view of the balcony would be disturbed. Captain Utari's description of the castle was accurate enough. Though Valentine had always pictured medieval-style castles as being much larger, he had seen pre-Kerr houses nearly as big as this walled hold. But close up, he could see why the Spectre chose this building for his lair. The towers, the narrow windows, the heavy stonework, even its grim, isolated location would appeal to a Kurian. Nothing but the insects disturbed him during the long, drowsy day in the field. The sun sank, the stars emerged, and Valentine removed his mind from his body. Again, the Reaper patrolled the edges of the fields as another stood in the tower, its head turning this way and that like a watchful owl. A curious fit of optics made the stars around the figure dimmer as Valentine stared, as if the thing were drawing the energy even from the twinkling star field. The Undertaker blew fitfully off the mountains, neither as strong nor as pleasant as its daytime sibling. An afternoon rain shower had left him cold and even more uncomfortable rather than refreshed.
Yeah.
And the omnipresent flies and ants took their turns at disturbing his self-hypnosis. Dawn approached, and a heavier rain set in, something Carrasco had assured him was almost unknown at this time of year. Valentine cursed the rain, the poor visibility, and Carrasco's meteorological acumen at dripping length. But with the sun, the clouds thinned and dissolved, fleeing in a burst of sky-flaming color. The Reaper retreated with the growing light of dawn. Valentine, muscles aching, fought the urge to rise, to try to gain a view of the bay that would allow him to see if the Thunderbolt approached. Her blockish ugliness would be a comfort to him, and if things went badly, what the Commodore called tits up, the gunboat's cannon could throw the coastline into enough confusion to allow him to escape. The women, on their way to their day's work in the fields, saw her first. Valentine watched them point and chatter, suffusing a warm wave of relief through his clammy body. He pressed Ankh's gun to his shoulder and checked the slide of the sight for the umpteenth time. The gun rested in an improvised bipod, a screwed-together contraption the chief designed to help him with the weight of the gun. He had tied lengths of creeper to the barrel, careful not to obscure the foresight over the dingy and green leather covering Ankh had sewn over the barrel. The gnarled, shillelagh-like stock was built for the grog's larger frame, but Valentine padded the end with canvas stuffed with sawdust so it fit snugly into the crook of his arm. He opened the bolt and slid one of the 50-caliber bullets into the breech. At this range, even firing upward, Ankh's shells would have a nearly flat trajectory. Valentine breathed slowly and deeply. He'd heard that the Kurians could sense life sign as easily as their Reapers, but precise information was scanty. With the waxing dawn, he knew that detection would grow even more difficult. Sunlight interfered with whatever waves humans emitted. He tried not to wonder what was transpiring in the dark castle. No doubt some daytime sentry had alerted his officer, who would have a look, then perhaps pass the word of the Thunderbolt's arrival to one of the Spectre's retinue. Valentine bet his life, so to speak, on the Kurian coming himself. The Spectre would wonder what the Thunderbolt's appearance portended. The Kur of New Orleans might have told him that their ship would be operating in his waters, but would he trust their word? She could mean the arrival of an ally in his on-again, off-again war with the pirates on the north coast, or an attempt by some other Kurian to supplant him and take the plentiful Aura fodder of the island. By the plan, Carrasco was to bring the Thunderbolt into the bay and put troops into her boats. The Kurian would be eager to see, from his faraway vantage, whether the approaching men would behave as friends or foes. The fortress came to life. Valentine watched two horsemen gallop out from behind the castle, one riding hard for the town and the other turning on the road west. As the riders galloped away, hanging onto their mounts' manes, three torsos appeared on the tower. They changed from silhouettes to figures in the growing light. One held a box with a high antenna waving back and forth in the confused airs that preceded the doctor's offshore breeze. Valentine hardened his eyes as the figures went to the edge of the balcony. He sighted down the barrel with his own telescopic vision. The view sharpened, details springing to life as his visual sense came at his will. The three figures became individual portraits. One was undoubtedly a Reaper, hood pulled well over its head to ward off the morning sun. Another a rail-thin black figure, perhaps a Jamaican. Between those two, a fleshy, sagging form emerged. The first Kurian Valentine was to hunt reminded him of a Buddha in flesh instead of bronze. The Kurians, like their Lifeweaver brethren, could appear as Eve's serpent or Abraham Lincoln if they wished. But this Kurian, for whatever reason, did not choose to put much effort into his human form. Hairless, with skin as gray as a corpse, it seemed to float to the balcony rather than walk. Valentine moved the rifle a fraction of an inch, putting the foresight squarely in the center of the Kurian's sagging chest. He placed his finger on the trigger and looked into the face of evil. Valentine felt a shudder creep up his spine as their eyes met over the distance. The Kurian read him and his intent in a flash of thought. Valentine's mind clouded. He felt a rush of vertigo, as if he were standing before an abyss. A kaleidoscope of color coalesced, filling his vision, a mental fog of chaos from which he would not return. He squeezed the trigger as he felt his will fleeing. The recoil of the shot jarred his frame, startled him like a slap in the face, breaking the psychic link. As through a haze, he saw a wound blossom at the Buddha statue's throat. The specter's jaw dropped open in a silent, gaping scream, even as the kick of the huge bullet flung it backwards, misting the back of the balcony with purplish fluid. But the disguise stayed. For a moment, Valentine feared that even Anka's bullet, big enough to drop an elephant, would not kill it. But then the head lolled. It sagged forward again, as if it were mounted on a rocking chair, and collapsed into something that looked like an umbrella with a bulbous octopus head at the top. Valentine heard a faint splat as it fell. The cat lay still, fighting the instinct to get up and flee. He knew his single shot would be hard to locate from any kind of distance, so he waited for the collapse he expected to begin. The Kurian no longer animated the Reaper. The cloaked figure stalked the balcony to slay in animal panic. It seized the thin man by the throat, popping off the Jamaican's head even as its mouth sank against the neck. Blood fountained, sprinkling the Reaper, the rail, and the castle wall as the beast dragged its victim into the shadows. While daylight lasted, Valentine had little to fear from the fiends now prowling the halls of the castle. With the link to the Kurian gone, the Reapers inside would mindlessly slay whoever remained behind the walls and trouble no one until darkness came. Any Reapers wandering the lands of the Spectre would probably do the same, grab a victim and retreat into a dark hole. Valentine felt a feral, id-tickling thrill at the thought of the fate of any of the Spectre's horsed police sharing shelter with the vampires. Eventually, and with proper organization, the masterless Reapers could be hunted and burned out of their holes. But that would have to come later. With chaos sitting in the Spectre's throne, the Kurian's realm would totter and be ripe for the taking. It was time for him and Anka to hasten its fall. As he crawled between the stalks, the freshly fed Reaper at the door to the balcony shielded its face from the morning sun and retreated into shadow. The Spectre had been dead for 22 hours, and his regime was melting away like ice in the Caribbean sun. Captain Utari had brought Valentine and Anka to a trailside village with mountains blue-green in the background, mottled by the shadows of clouds. Faint sounds of gunfire echoed from the direction of the main road to Kingston. Armed Jamaicans of every description, from a blue-eyed Scandinavian or two to glossy African, filled every piece of shade in the village. Most carried machetes and a smattering of old rifles. The smell of roasting pigs, horse meat, and corn came from clay or brick ovens and oil drums used as barbecues.
More come every day.
Not enough. Not enough for the town I saw.
He, the Thunderbolt's Groggs, and Utari's men had been hidden on the outskirts of Kingston.
Don't forget our people and the city folks. We waited for the day of liberation. When Obey make a promise...
Her prediction, you mean?
A prediction from Obey is a promise. Brian, man, you're the proof.
So this is the crying man.
If Obey was over 6 feet, it was by the width of an eyelash. Nor did she have four breasts. There was enough flesh on her beneath her woven robes, like Joseph's composed of many hues, to make it look as though she had an extra set. She had liver-spotted skin the color of milky tea and a crinkled forehead with gray-black hair drawn back in tight braids. Obey walked with the help of two men, sons, Valentine soon learned, and a pair of canes. They went into a whitewashed brick house at the center of the village's only street, 60 or 70 feet of asphalt flanked by gravel roads. The owner of the house welcomed them with hugs before she and her family went back to bobbing before Obey. There was an oddly dressed retinue to either side of the oracle. One wore what looked to be the final remnants of a priest's vestments. The other had gold tassels and yellow braiding sewn to the shoulder of a sleeveless green dress army coat.
Thank you, boys.
She extended a hand. Valentine shook it, touching a heavy ring on her forefinger with a jewel the size of a pea. He took another look, trying to read the script, as Anka engulfed her hand in his long fingers.
Yale, I would have been class of 23.
She stuck out her hand. The knuckles were enlarged with arthritis. It was a pretty thing, but it looked like a man's. Valentine wasn't sure what to say, so he fell back on what his father used to ask the educated of the old order. What did you study?
Pre-law. I buried the needle on my SATs.
SATs?
S-A-T's. Scholastic Aptitude Tests.
Valentine was flummoxed.
Huh. You had to do well on those to be allowed to learn? Sounds self-defeating.
There's a long answer, but it's not important. Of course, it didn't hurt that my father was a vice president with General Mills. I started as a freshman with a major in anthropology. Then I got a taste of academics in college politics. I wised up by the end of my sophomore year. I switched to pre-law. With a history minor, I'd always enjoyed it, and you should take your share of fun those years.
Never had the opportunity, unless you count some classes at a shoestring war college. They didn't give out souvenirs.
The assembly took their seats on chairs ringing the main room of the tiny house, except for Anka. The bench he tried let out such a groan that he shifted his buttocks forward to a comfortable squat with the bench as a backrest. Obey looked down at her ring.
I was doing an internship in Boston when the rabies hit. I ended up on a cleanup crew behind a guard unit, loading bodies. Even martial law was breaking down. It didn't look like there'd be bar exams for a while. I saw the ring on a body. He had a suit with a good $3,000. Then thought, what the hell?
Boston's a long way from Jamaica.
My father pulled every string with every man he'd ever known.
Did he make it out with you?
He didn't even try. The airport was a nightmare. Gun battles between Boston police and Massachusetts state troopers and the National Guard. Nobody had orders. People crying, begging. I saw a man shoot himself right in front of his family.
She related her story without the shocked, vacant look that Valentine had seen on so many survivors of those days.
I got flown down here with a bunch of children in a jet with enough fuel for a one-way trip. I guess there was a rumor that Jamaica was rabies-free. A lot of the kids were sitting two and three to a seat. Babies crying. It was a frightening ride. The bombs were going off by then, and planes were dropping from the electromagnetic pulse. There was an army captain on board. Talked to me and the kids through it. We ended up married just before I had my first boy.
She looked at the man in the vestments. Now that Valentine knew her face, he saw a hint of Obey around the son's eyes.
Your visions are pretty accurate. A law firm could have used that, predicting a judge's decisions.
Oh, that came later. Wasn't something I was born with. Given to me. I suspect you know a few life weavers, too.
Valentine said nothing.
One came to Jamaica. He had a small group of men. I suppose they were some kind of special forces. A mixture of Americans and British and Cuban soldiers, I think. Going by the flags on the uniforms. The visit was brief. He was being chased.
The light broke through Valentine's doubts.
I didn't understand much of what he had to say. I never even learned his name. Everyone called him the brother. It made him sound like a Mormon or an Amish or whoever that was that called each other that. Then I found out he was more like the brother from another planet. He said I was going to be part of a new communications network, a biological one. They had me drink some kind of goop out of a tequila bottle, and I passed out for a few hours. When I came around, the brother character was speaking in my head. Soon as he saw I was alive and getting his words without him using his mouth, he started glowing and told the rest, "Obey her," pointing at me, you see. Then he and the soldiers left. It made an impression on the kids. Everyone kept looking at me and repeating, "Obey." Dwayne, my captain, had us go into a town in the mountains. Whatever he did to me, he didn't quite take, at least in the way you think telepathy should work. I get strange images now and then. Visions, pictures, sounds sometimes. Just had an audio last week with a lot of gunfire and explosions. The vision about you. It was a gray ship that seemed to be made of thunderclouds, and I saw your face, clear as I see it now. Your friend, Mr. Ankar, he was part of the clouds too, with lightning in his eyes and fingertips.
What do you see for the future?
Nothing from the brother. But the men my sons lead will take care of their end, if your ships can help us with the garrison in Kingston.
They come. They come tomorrow, Obey.
And then what?
Obey looked at the ceiling. The island's panoply absorbed her for a moment. Then she returned her eyes to Valentine.
A new Jamaica. For all the factions, I hope and pray. With the specter gone, even the cockpit country might see reason.
And you?
Obey played with her ring, twirling it on the shrunken digit between the enlarged knuckles.
Might end up using the old law studies before I die after all. What kind of constitution do you folks operate under there in the Ozarks?
They're landing now.
Valentine looked down from his perch on a rooftop water tower at Kingston in turmoil. 2 days after the death of the Spectre, the Thunderbolt and a pair of three-masted clippers sailed into the harbor as though in a naval show. All three ships were filled to overflowing with every willing man of the Commodore's who could shoulder a rifle. Faint booms came up from the docks. The Thunderbolt's guns systematically blasted the harbor defenses. The posts were manned by the few troops still obeying orders under the Horst police officer. A Horst police officer named Colonel Say had tried to take control of the Spectre's organization. Valentine and Anka, through their Kingston contacts, probably knew more about Say's struggle to assume the reins than the warlord himself. Formerly in charge of the city's garrison, the colonel managed to keep many of his troops together, even as the public police vanished into the countryside. Valentine had to admire Say's execution, if not his methods. A storeroom beside the regimental stables held the bodies of rivals and subordinates who failed to agree with his plan for Jamaica's future. The same grapevine passed word to the inhabitants of Kingston that with the arrival of the ships, the north side of the island would finish the liberation of the south. The sons of Obey guided Valentine and Anka to the city, and the Jamaicans filled rooms and streets with men and women eager to meet the crying man who had delivered them from the Spectre. As they moved from village to city, time after time, Valentine felt the touch of eager hands, as if physical contact with him somehow guaranteed their freedom. Now, buildings burned, and the clatter of hooves and echoing shots told the tale of the rising city. Ever since Valentine's arrival, machete and club had been matched against horse and gun, but without the Spectre's organization and Reapers, Say's command had begun to crack. The booming arrival of the Thunderbolt and the Commodore's flotilla turned confusion into collapse. Valentine, Anka, and a group of armed Jamaicans had occupied what in the late world had been a professional building of some kind. It was three stories of whitewashed brick, with broad balconies servicing the network of rooms inside. Until the Spectre's death, it had been a barracks of the public police. Valentine chose it for its view of the city and the main road north out of town. Equally useful for holding up reinforcements or Colonel Say's troops, its strategic location demanded occupation with what forces he could organize. The enthusiastic Jamaicans, led by men and women who had sprung seemingly from nowhere, had barricaded the highway before the buildings and lined the railings of the balconies with mattresses and furniture. Anyone trying to pass along the highway would hit the choke point and come under gunfire at a range that made skill superfluous. Anka looked out across the rooftops from beneath a straw hat and canvas parasol. Despite his fawn-colored fur and thick hide, he suffered from Jamaica's sun more than his bronze-skinned friend. They stood together on a tiny platform running around the edges of a rooftop water tower supplying the barracks.
And the police, my David. How are they reacting?
Valentine watched the Thunderbolt spit fire from her Orlikon into a rusted crane, one of the harbor's few strong points still fighting. A body, ant-size at the distance, plummeted from the tower.
They're running. Looks like they have a dock secured. Polaris and Vega are being tied up to the docks. They didn't even have to send in boats. It's almost over.
But not for us.
The cat turned his gaze to the captain's compound.
Looks like Say has seen enough. Two trucks are being loaded up at headquarters. Horses, too. Hell, they're firing into the mob again. Wait. Yes, they're coming this way. The informants were right. He's gonna run north toward the mountain stations. Better get your grogs to the windows.
The Golden One picked up his long gun and moved to the roof access ladder. Valentine watched the column for another minute, just to make certain of its direction. Say's men had perhaps been unnerved. The group leaving the barracks was as much of a mob as the Jamaicans hurling rocks from the alleys. He swung down from the water tower and jumped to the gravel-covered roof, careful to land on his good leg. The work ahead would be bloody. He hoped it would be brief. Allowing Colonel Say to escape into the countryside with even a nucleus of armed men might mean trouble for the Commodore and the Jamaicans in the days ahead. It would take weeks to organize an occupation of the various stations, forts, and barracks strung out across the Spectre's lands. In the meantime, others might rally around the Colonel. Picking up his old Russian-made gun with its drum clip, Valentine hurried down to the first floor. Grinning Jamaicans all around brandished their weapons and called out to him in their local patois. He understood only a phrase or two.
They don't come in, man.
We cut their back asses now.
Valentine nodded to their officer and went out to the front of the building. He and Anka walked the balconies, cutting a serpentine trail down to the first floor, nodding and clapping the Jamaicans on the shoulder.
Keep down and wait for the horn. Keep down and wait for the horn.
He said it over and over again, until it became as much of a sing-song as their greetings. He looked out at the barricade from the first floor, where Anka's grogs waited, covering the street from the windows and doors of the front of the building. What had been a parking lot sloped down to the highway. Carts and wreckage had been arranged to force any traffic moving up the road to negotiate a hairpin turn. Valentine wanted the obstacle to look to be the result of accident rather than design, so Say would stick his neck well into the trap before it snapped shut. Valentine knelt behind the walkway barricade and searched southward with his hard ears. He picked up the sound of diesel and hooves. He nodded to Anka, who had been walking back and forth in front of his grogs, grunting out orders as he moved along the sidewalk fronting the shuttered windows. Anka picked up a tarnished circular horn, an ancient fox-hunting relic from Jamaica's colonial past. It had been gathering cobwebs on the walls of the barracks until one of the grogs decided it would make an interesting headband. The first horses reached the barricade, galloping pell-mell up the potholed road. Some fools fired from one of the upper levels, but neither the riders nor the horses took hit or heed. A horse vaulted over the frame of a broken sofa, unseating its rider. Valentine let the others pass and chambered around in the PPD. The first of the mass of riders trotted into view, coming up over a rise in the road like ships appearing over the horizon. Behind the clattering riders came the grinding gears of the two trucks and the higher-pitched farting of a motorbike. Anka barked something to his grogs.
Wait for the signal.
He spoke loudly enough so it would carry to the balcony above him.
Wait.
The riders approached.
Wait.
The horsed police slowed their horses to a walk as they saw the obstacles.
Wait.
Now he could see the trucks, beds crammed with equipment, furnishings, and loot. Women and children, probably families of some of the Horst police, rode atop and among the cargo. Corrugated aluminum welded over the doors and windows protected the driver and passenger. A motorcycle with a sidecar puttered before the big diesels, but the sidecar held only a mound of possessions rather than a passenger ready to fire the machine gun mounted there. More soldiers jogged amongst the mob, already panting and casting aside their weapons in an attempt to keep up with the engines and horses. Strained, anxious faces in a dozen different skin tones looked warily at the partially blocked road and to the buildings at either side. The vanguard of horsemen did not like what they saw and called to their fellows, drawing rifles and shotguns from saddle sheaths. Valentine nodded at Anka, who blew into the circular horn. Wide-shouldered grogs filled the windows and doors of the first floor of the barracks. Valentine heard shots crack from above. Horses screamed and plunged as their riders turned tail, fell out of the saddle, or dismounted by flinging themselves to the ground. Valentine dropped two uniformed Jamaicans shouting orders. The PPD chattered out its harsh coda as he aimed short bursts into the crowd. Anka methodically fired his rifle into the aluminum-covered cabins of the vehicles. The 50-caliber rounds blasted thumb-sized holes in the plating and slumped the drivers within. Cartridges fell like brassy hail from the balconies above as the Jamaicans emptied their weapons into the mob. The motorcycle roared to life. Its uniformed rider gunned it, expertly swerving around dying horses and between the barricades. The cyclist threw his hips off the saddle to counterweight the tight slalom. The colorful insignia on the rider's uniform tipped Valentine to his identity. Say. He fired a burst, but missed the racing figure.
Anka! The motorcycle!
Anka stood and took a round from his mouth. In battle, the grog kept cartridges in his lips, tucked into his flexible ears, and between his knuckles. He closed the breech of his gun, sighted, and fired. The bullet's impact threw the rider bodily into the motorcycle's handlebars. The bike spun sideways and crashed. One truck, its driver dead, went nose first into the ditch at the side of the highway. Riders and cargo tumbled forward and out. The truck behind halted, dead horses blocking its path. Jamaicans flooded the street, wielding improvised weapons. Some grabbed the unwounded horses and ran off, leading their prizes. Others leapt into the trucks, looking for booty. But most of the mob concentrated their energies on the hated Horst police.
Cease fire!
At a word from Anka, the grogs put up their smoking guns. Years of death and brutal treatment resulted in ugly scenes in the street. Whole and wounded Horst police, their hands raised in surrender, fell victim to the mob. A few Jamaicans flung themselves over the wounded and protected them from the clubs and knives with their own flesh, but the mob merely sought out other targets. Valentine heard women's screams and saw some of the Horst police's children caught up in the mob's fury. A child fell under a club, skull opened and yellow-gray brains spilling to the pavement. Valentine shouldered his way into the crowd, stepping over bodies of the dead and dying, and jumped on the cab of the second truck. He fired his gun in the air.
Enough!
Anka grabbed a horse, threw off its saddle, and mounted. He led his grogs into the fray. The spectacle of the strange ape-like creatures distracted the mob enough for Valentine to get their attention. Eyes turned to Valentine and the grogs.
Enough!
He forced a grin to his face.
The time of death is over!
The mob turned from rage to celebration. Jamaicans joined Valentine atop the truck, waving their arms and calling out to their fellows. Something gave way inside the exhausted cat. He stood in the celebrating throng, shaking with exhaustion and emotion. He realized his head hurt. The sun struck his eyes like knives. He summoned a few Jamaicans and began to carry the surviving wounded into the shelter of the barracks. As his hands grew sticky with sweat and blood, Valentine thought of the clean sea. Hispaniola, April. The largest island of the Caribbean has a record of woe. The rugged land remembers only moments of peace in its long history of strife and sorrow. Rule by colonial aristocrats, despots, corporations, or military dictatorships made no difference to the impoverished inhabitants. The new boss, as the 20th century song said, was much the same as the old one. The passage of the Kurians across their green island made the rest of their unhappy past a mere warm-up for the horrors to come. The island's role as one of the first gateways of the Kurs' invasion shrank the populace from the millions to the thousands. When the Kurians arrived, their reapers hunted down the Hispaniolans in even the most remote villages on their way north, south, and west. The few slaughter-shocked inhabitants of the island remember these years in oral tradition as La Fiesta de Diablos. The beauty of the island stands in contrast to the ugliness of its history. Royal palms tower over empty towns, vanishing under a carpet of leafy vines. Nature, left to itself, covered the eroded scars left by charcoal gatherers in a dozen years. Cackling colonies of birds flit from enormous palm to enormous palm over an ocean of lesser trees and creepers. Gulls and sandpipers congregate on empty beaches, nesting in washed-up fishing boats. Further inland, wild dogs and pigs hunt and root through new and thriving forests. What civilization there is exists on the east side of the island, where the Kurian families rule a retinue of Quislings from the gray ziggurat of the Columbus Lighthouse. A few coastal communities dot the perimeter of the island, sending tribute to the Dark Lords in the east. Their combined reapers hunt farther inland, or land here and there along the coast in search of auras. Perhaps something of the spirit of Columbus has entered the Santo Domingo Kurians, for they are some of the few who venture into the sea in ships in their predatory wanderings along Hispaniola's long coastline. The appearance of the Kurian Drakkar send whole towns fleeing into the mountains. It was not a bad storm. The spring storm lashing the channel in between Hispaniola and Cuba made up in bluster for what it lacked in size. Valentine watched Captain Carrasca on the Thunderbolt's bridge. A knotted rope and a stick, in a curious mix of hairstyle and seamanship, restricted her thick hair to the back of her head. She stood next to the wheel, bending first one knee and then the other, as she rolled with the ship's motion like a slow metronome, owlish eyes watching the storm. Since leaving Jamaica, gaps in the crew filled with the Commodore's sailors, Carrasca had taught Valentine a good deal about the islands of the Caribbean. Keys and atolls where some found refuge, larger islands such as Cuba and Cozumel, which fed the appetite of the Kurians. She knew winds and weather, currents and courses, radio procedure and sail setting. She spoke of them as easily as Valentine could describe his old platoons in the Wolves.
How's the rudder?
Fighting fine. She's a heavy ship, all that steel in this old ice shover. Wouldn't care to ride this out in the Gideon. We'd have to heave to.
She's working. We're shipping more water than I'd like. The sea hasn't worked up much. I'd put it at 3 meters.
4 sometimes, Cap.
Any sign of the coast?
Valentine tried to pierce the rain-filled darkness forward.
By dead reckoning, it's there. I don't dare get much closer. The best harbors are on the other side of the island, and we can't use them.
Cool and professional. The warm moment they shared that night on the balcony where she admitted her thrill at her command seemed like a childhood game of you show me yours and I'll show you mine. Now she just watched him every now and then out of the corner of her eye, as though checking the professional wall between them for cracks.
Your ships don't land here.
Nothing worth landing for, except fresh water or firewood. We hit richer lands. Now Cuba, there's good hunting there, especially on the north coast, and in the stretch between it and the Florida Peninsula.
My work is on Hispaniola, the Haiti side.
I'll get you there. Nothing's going to happen until this blows itself out, Valentine.
I'll try and sleep. Have me woken if this clears, please.
Valentine descended from the bridge, weaving past a mix of the Thunderbolt's old crew and new shipmates from Jamaica. He went to his cabin, formerly shared with Post, who now lay almost recovered in sick bay, thanks to the skilled teams of Jayport's aged hospital ship. Sea air and sun were speeding his recovery, but the former coastal marine was still not up and around for more than a few hours a day. Anka was on the cabin floor. The quarters smelled of Anka's horsey odor and vomit, the contents of the Golden One's stomach having abandoned ship when the storm started.
My David, take out your pistol and put an end to my suffering.
He lay on his stomach with four-fingered hands clasped over his pointed ears.
Carrasca says it won't last long, old horse.
The motion stimulated Valentine, if anything, though he longed for surcease of the endless sounds of rain, wind, and the ship groaning in the weather.
Oh, it's a new hell each hour.
What's that?
Valentine dropped into his bunk.
My people say there are four hells. The Theosophists need to add one more. The Hell of Motion.
Valentine placed his boots on the floor, tucked them away from Anka's head in case the grog decided to bring up another 10 gallons of digestive matter. Best to keep his friend's mind on something else.
They left out a hell?
Anka lay silent, as if gathering his words and putting them into English.
The Golden Ones believe that you must be purified by hell before gaining paradise. There is a hell of hunger and thirst, a hell of pain, a hell of illness, and a hell of loneliness. If you suffer deeply of these in your life, you are spared them after death and reach paradise that much quicker.
That's a lot of suffering to reach heaven.
By our creed, only through suffering do you grow a soul capable of understanding others and appreciating the... what is it? The word for grace of gods?
Valentine thought for a moment.
Beatitude?
I must look that up as soon as I can open my eyes again. I've never heard it. English has too many words for some things and not enough for others. You take too long in the telling. Your words can never match the music of our proverb verse.
I'll work through a King James Bible with you. It'll change your opinion.
Oh, those tracts. Most of them read like the family history of a group of nomad fumfraisers. One of your theosophists tried to instill in me a belief in my own soul, and me having tasted only the bitter surface of the hell of loneliness and hell of pain in the time before we met. The fool. As if paradise could be gained by affirming the divinity of some human.
I've always thought there was more to it than that, my friend.
My David, if you wish to learn the true path to paradise, you must read of the Golden One's rhapsodies. Then you will be steeled to torments that must be overcome before a joyful afterlife.
There are 450 ways of constructing tribal lays, and every single one of them are right.
Then, what is your opinion of your gods?
God? You mean Bud?
There is only one. I thought you had two or three.
Depends on who you talk to.
Valentine sank into his bunk. On his back, the ship's motion seemed to tilt him head down first, then feet down.
I don't remember anyone calling your god Bob.
Bud. It's from an old story the top sergeant from Zulu Company used to tell.
Old stories are the best ones. The bad ones die young. Tell me about Bud.
Valentine sifted his memory.
The sergeant's name was Patel. He was built almost as broad as you. Hell of a wrestler, too. And he always fought clean, unless someone tried something. Then it was anything goes. But back to the story. Before he was in the Wolves, he fought with the regulars, the guards.
Yes, I've seen them. Good guns, better uniforms, and the best food.
They can fight when it comes to it. I think when Patel was with them, they didn't have the nicest clothing, especially where he was. He said it started while he was watching the ground south of St. Louis. For a while there, it was trench warfare. The men and the grogs working for the Kurians were trying to blast them out of these hills with artillery. Got so there wasn't a tree standing. But the guards just kept digging and digging. They'd built little caves of wood with tons of dirt overhead. They were called dugouts. Anyway, he was young, and he had this real nervous NCO running the dugout these 20 men were crammed into. The damn grogs... sorry, old horse. The damn Kurian grogs started building these rockets they were launching off of railroad rails, and they had enough of a bang in them to collapse a dugout. And when those babies landed, Patel said it felt like someone picked up the hill and dropped it again. The concussion outside was enough to stop your heart. Well, this corporal starts to lose it. They're in there, and it's dark and cold and wet, with the noise and smell of burnt flesh, as if that isn't bad enough. It seems like any minute they're gonna get blown to hell. Get friendly with God, this corporal starts shouting. The time's coming, and you better know him! You gotta know God and be on a first-name basis with him to get into heaven! Hurry up, guys! Of course, some of the men just tell him to shut up, but you've always got a joker or two who thinks a nervous breakdown is entertainment, so they start quizzing him. Praise Jesus, one hollers, trying to egg him on. I'm talking about God, not Jesus, the corporal says. He keeps looking at the ceiling of the dugout. Know him, love him. Okay, what's God's name then? The corporal doesn't even think about it. He says Bud right away. Some of the guys think that this is just too funny to let go. Bud is my shepherd, I shall not want, one starts to say. They start misquoting stuff like, praise Bud, and Bud, bless this stewed rat, which I'm about to eat and probably puke up again.
Oh, skip the food part.
Well, after a couple minutes of humor like that, some old soldier yells, shut your Bud damn mouths for Bud's freaking sake. The corporal loses it, says he's not going to stay in there with a bunch of blasphemers, and he heads out of the dugout with the shells and rockets still landing all over the hills. Patel thinks the corp is going to get killed, so he goes out after him. Patel catches up to him 30 yards away and jumps on him, wrestles him to the ground in the trench, when one of those rail rockets lands right on the dugout. Kills every man in there. Either the blast or suffocation did him in. Now Patel and a bunch of others, even the corporal, tried to dig out the shelter to rescue them, but no luck. Sure enough, some of the bodies are blue, and this corporal starts pointing at the ones who got suffocated and saying, Bud's Mark, and things like that. Patel and this corporal get out of the trenches and are posted with a new unit in western Missouri in the bushwhack ground. This corporal seems sound enough most of the time, but now and then he points out the color blue and says, the hand of Bud, or something like that. And one day they're on patrol on a footpath and he just freezes, with his head cocked like a dog listening to a whistle. He says that Bud's whispering in my ear. A couple of the guys pass him, maybe they thought he was taking a leak without bothering to use his fly, and go right into a tripwire that fires this harpoon through two men. Patel said he started to think that old expression about God looking out for drunks, children, and idiots might be true. After that, this corporal turned into the kind of NCO that stays behind to watch over the sick and the supplies. Until this one day, there's a beautiful blue sky. So he decides to climb a tree and look at Bud's handiwork. He falls asleep up there. No one knows where he is. They figure this time he's really flipped and run off into the woods. They don't even bother looking for him. Which is too bad, because if they had been dispersed, these three reapers passing through the area wouldn't have caught all that life sign in the camp. They went in and killed everyone but the corporal. Maybe when he was in the tree talking to Bud, he didn't put out much more life sign than a cuckoo clock. After that, the corporal pulled kitchen duty at an infantry training school by Mountain Home. Patel ended up joining some wolves who were hunting the reapers, made himself useful when they caught up to the bastards, and ended up in Zulu company. Funny thing is, every now and then in a tight situation, I'd catch Patel saying, Bud, help me, or something like that. I don't think he really believed it, but Patel wasn't taking any chances.
The storm blew itself out overnight. Valentine arose and dressed around the slumbering Anka. He checked Post, who slept with his familiar snore in the tiny sickbay. The indefatigable Carrasca still stood on the bridge. She looked as fresh and alert as when Valentine had last seen her, rocking with the storm.
That's Haiti, Valentine. Dead ahead.
Valentine stepped out onto the wing of the bridge. Something loomed ahead, a heavy presence in the darkness. As the light grew, he could make out mountains coated in green. Carrasca joined him in the open air.
Why the white knuckles?
Valentine looked down at the decorative wood top to the rail where his hand gripped the painted metal.
For over a year, I've been trying to get here in the right kind of ship.
Worth it, I hope. The Commodore thinks you're chasing a rumor. Said it reminded him of the years after the Koreans first came, where ships and men were lost, looking for remnants of the old society.
That's what my father was doing when he ran into a lifeweaver. This chase is something the lifeweavers put me on.
She put binoculars to her eyes and searched the coast ahead.
How much do you know?
There's something on that island the cause needs.
The cause?
You sound like Hawthorne of the Hasty Retreat.
Valentine involuntarily stiffened. Now a row of ghostly bodies lay between them. Friends Valentine had lost, talents the world had lost, in the sake of the cause.
I'm sorry.
She looked away.
You've proved yourself to Jamaica.
But not to you.
It's the same thing.
Valentine stifled a laugh. He might have said those exact words. Jensen and Carrasca had proved themselves to the cause by letting him use the ship. The same thing as proving themselves to him. He took his hands from the rail and rubbed life back into them.
Why is it nobody's thought to go get this, whatever it is, until now?
We didn't know it was there. It was put there hundreds of years ago by a lifeweaver. He lived in secret among us with a few followers. He guessed what the Kurians were planning, but he only knew about the one door. He and his people were ready for what was coming on Haiti. But something happened. They were betrayed, and I don't think anyone survived. One of the followers kept a journal of some kind, more as a record of that lifeweaver's teachings, but in it was a section about this weapon against them. Like a lot of places, there's a resistance against the Kurians. These Haitians are fighting without really knowing what they're fighting. They just know it's evil, and they're doing what they can to protect their own people. They found a cache of weapons in a cave, along with this diary. They made sense of it, and somehow word got passed to us. I never knew about it. I just got orders to join up with the Quislings on the Gulf Coast with fake papers and background. I think they chose me because I speak a little Spanish and French. My mother was from the French part of Canada, and I was raised by a priest from Puerto Rico. It took me a year, but I got into the Coastal Marines and managed to get myself posted to the right kind of ship to bring it back. It's a year I wouldn't care to repeat. Now it's like life in the Ozarks is something out of my childhood.
Is there snow there?
Sometimes, in winter. The mountains aren't big enough to be snow-capped year-round. Why?
There's a story the people here tell. They think if you go somewhere there's snow all the time, like the North Pole, the Kurians can't get you. It's all mixed up with stories about Christmas now, that there's this place everyone is safe from them, with plenty of food and electronic toys and no fighting.
Valentine watched a frigate bird float above, drifting on the air currents with only the tiniest alterations to its wing.
If only. I grew up almost in Canada. It gets colder in the winter than you can probably imagine, and the Reapers still made it up there. They don't come in winter, but we're still not out of it. You go much further north from there, and the land can't support many people year-round away from the coasts. Just not enough to eat. And the old-timers say the climate is strange now. Summers are longer and hotter, but somehow winter is even worse. God knows how the Kurians managed it. There's no safe place. Or if there is, they're keeping it to themselves.
She nodded.
Cape Haitian is ahead. What is the plan?
The plan is to sail into the port as bold as if we have the proverbial balls of the brass monkey. We have a contact in town who'll get in touch with me. He's on lookout for a ship from the north. Not sure what happens after that. Maybe we pull out and land somewhere nearby on the coast, and he gets in touch with the resistance. They load us up, and back we go.
Will it be that easy?
Valentine found a smile.
Somehow I doubt it.
The Thunderbolt rounded Cape Haitian and turned her prow to the town, a cluster of white and gray snuggled into a stretch of flat land with mountains towering behind. The vivid colors of the Caribbean struck Valentine once more. Deep blues of the ocean, brilliant blues and whites above, and behind stretches of white sand, a green so lush it hypnotized. Fishing boats, hardly more than canoes, rocked in the gentle swell. Tall, lean black men threw nets into the water and gathered them again. If they noticed the Thunderbolt, they showed no sign of it. As the ship approached, Valentine observed that the fishermen were either naked or wearing stringy loincloths. Wiry muscle glistened under the sun. A boat with four oarsmen put out from the docks. Its splashing approach scattered seabirds bobbing on the calm surface of the bay. Carrasca called into the bridge.
Dead slow.
Dead slow, aye aye.
The bulky ship coasted to a crawl. The small boat cut across the prow, as if blocking the larger vessel's entry. A man in a simple gray uniform stood and put a speaking trumpet to his mouth.
Kebato!
What did he say?
What ship is that?
I thought they spoke Spanish here.
Creole French, mostly, or a form of it. But you can get along in Spanish, too. Thunderbolt! New Orleans! May we anchor here tonight? We will buy food.
What do you do here?
We chase pirates. Have any sailing ships passed?
No, not close. Not since before the last hurricane season.
May we drop anchor?
The man lowered his speaking trumpet for a moment, then raised it again.
For now, our officer will come. Do not lower your boat until then.
Thank you!
The same four-oared boat brought out the officer. Valentine watched him make the transition to the Thunderbolt with a fair amount of agility. He wore a similar uniform to his underling, though with gold buttons and a brilliant scarlet sash beneath his pistol belt. Valentine went to greet him.
Monsieur speak French.
His features were exaggerated. Strong cheekbones, a pointed chin, knife-like nose, wide eyes, and handsome in a sensual, full-lipped way. Unlike most of the Hispaniolans Valentine had observed in the boats, who either had a full beard or were clean-shaved, he wore a mustache.
And some Spanish.
Valentine realized, as visitor, it would be best if he began the introductions.
My captain is more comfortable in Spanish. I am Lieutenant Rowan of the Coastal Marines.
Valentine turned to introduce Carrasca. She wore a combination of her own Jamaican attire and a coat liberated from Captain Saunders' chest.
Sí, bueno. Muy encantado.
He touched his chest.
El Capitán Bull. I understand you wish to make use of our market?
Even with a table fan blowing, the air settled wet and thick on the three people gathered in the small space of the captain's cabin.
We have only a few liters of diesel oil, I am sorry to say.
My captain has ample fuel, but some fresh food and, of course, water would be most appreciated. We can barter or pay in gold.
Ours is a poor market, unless you count fish. Though, once word got around that you wish to buy, the people would bring in chickens, eggs, pigs, fresh fruit, and vegetables. It would take only a day or two more, and your ship would be fully provisioned.
Carrasca exchanged a look with Valentine and shook her head.
I must be at sea again. The damned pirates have too long a lead, even now.
In our mutual interest, I will ask the fishermen as they come in. They see ships, especially in the waters between here and Cuba.
If you hear any news between now and when we leave tomorrow, we would be most obliged. A few hours are all we need to replenish our fresh water supply.
Bull put up his hands placatingly.
My friends, if you choose to stay, I can guarantee most advantageous terms for your barter in the market. Our people will have little use for gold, but tools, trinkets, even pencils and papers will get you much good food.
Valentine leaned forward in his chair.
Captain, do you have some special reason to have us stay here?
Bull drummed his fingers on the table, but stopped as soon as he looked down and realized what he was doing.
I will lay my cards down, as you New Orleans gamblers say. Though we pay tribute to the cursed ones on the other side of the island, we still suffer their torments. Even now, one of their drakkar, a wooden vessel known as the shark fin, approaches. On it are the drinkers of death, the robed ones who come in the dark. A ship such as yours in the harbor will make them think again about anchoring. I saw your gun. It would blow the shark fin into kindling. Our market is poor because even at the rumor of one of the drakkar, the dragon ships, my people fly to the mountains.
We can't stay here forever. And were we to destroy the shark fin, New Orleans would hear about it, and it would be trouble for us.
But you may save us this season. This would not hurt your patrol, perhaps 3 days here. And I do mean what I say about making inquiries among the fishermen. You may buy what you will, and each day you stay, your men will feast on what my poor town can provide. We make a very good warm vodka, even from potatoes.
Carrasca nodded.
So be it. We shall stay a few days. We'll anchor so our gun can cover the sea. And your town, in case of treachery, Captain Bull.
Thank you, Captain. You are helping my people a great deal. Though I cannot blame you for thinking it. Do not fear treachery.